This episode of Studio 360 is supported by Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of Studio 360 and PRI's other shows while on the go without downloading or syncing with Stitcher Smart Radio. Thousands of popular podcasts and programs are available on demand. Stitcher instantly delivers new episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone without syncing or downloading. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/studio.
The Civil War ain't over.
150 years ago this week, the Civil War broke out. For some Americans, the war never really ended.
We're in a city where you can touch buildings that were scarred by the war.
Today in Studio 360, we look at how the Civil War changed our culture. Take Matthew Brady. His pictures from the battlefields inspired generations of photojournalists. But a lot of the pictures were staged.
He added props. He added a gun. Any Civil War history buff would know that there would be no gun left after a battle. Those guns were too valuable.
And we'll hear from modern Americans who take their guns to the old battlefields, not just for sport.
It's not big boys playing with big toys. It's a case of getting in touch with your own heritage.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and lots more is ahead today in Studio 360. Right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
A house divided against itself cannot stand.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
From the rude and stirring wars, was my brother in the battle.
This week, April 12th, is the 150th anniversary of the rebels' attack on Fort Sumter, the start of the bloodiest, most unfinished war in American history. And lately, I've been thinking of that great line about history repeating itself: the first time is tragedy, the second time is farce. In 2009, Governor Rick Perry of Texas suggested that his state would consider seceding from the United States if the federal government keeps overreaching.
We got a great union. There's absolutely no reason to dissolve it. But if Washington continues to thumb their nose at the American people, you know, who knows what may come out of that.
Texas says, go to hell, Washington, which, by the way, has been said before.
Do you think there comes a point where a state may say, we've had it, goodbye?
I'm sure there is, but we're not seeing, we're not anywhere
close to it. They did it in 1861.
Yeah, I mean, no, I'm talking about right now.
Is the Civil War so far in the past that we've forgotten the price we paid? One out of every 25 American men died. Or maybe did we never quite stop fighting it? I'm always amazed that when you look at a map of the so-called red states and blue states on various issues, for the states that existed in 1861, it pretty closely tracks the map of the Union and the Confederacy.
At almost every point in American history, we've felt like we're on the verge of civil war.
Adam Goodhart is an historian and journalist. He's also a contributor to the terrific New York Times blog Disunion, which has been chronicling the beginning of the war day by day since last fall. And his new book is called 1861.
I think every generation sort of brings its own concerns, its own times to its understanding and its obsession with the Civil War. And in fact, the Civil War became a kind of a political football in the civil rights struggle. And that was the moment when the Confederate flag was actually sort of resurrected as a symbol. So today, I sort of think of my book as a post 9/11 Civil War book.
How so?
Well, you know, that moment of the first shot on Fort Sumter was a kind of a 9/11 moment for the nation.
It changed everything.
It changed everything. And until 9/11, I don't think I really fully understood how just one moment and one experience in one place and one attack, a relatively limited attack. We're talking about 80 soldiers on a little two-acre island in the middle of Charleston
Harbor. None of whom got hurt.
None of whom got hurt, exactly, yeah. The only casualty during the battle was one Confederate horse. And yet it just goes, Walt Whitman wrote, the word traveled through the land as if on electric nerves. And I thought, gosh, that sounds familiar.
And, of course, there was a brand new set of electric nerves in the form of the telegraph.
That's right.
It's also amazing to me how quickly it went from unthinkable secession and this war to inevitable, and here we are doing it.
That's right. I do think that we're living in a time that's in some ways similar to the politics of the 1850s and 60s in terms of the sort of national echo chamber that we're in and just these sort of quickly escalating levels of vitriol that in the 1860s, as today, had to do with new media, had to do with this incredible boom in the press, with the development of the telegraph that spread more quickly than the internet has in our own time.
And in 1845, there was no telegraph. By 1860, everywhere was wired.
Suddenly, you know, people in Massachusetts could hear what people were saying in South Carolina about them, and it wasn't very nice.
In your new media blog on the New York Times, which is tracing the history of the coming apart of the Union day by day, you've gotten different kinds of comments from commenters online depending on where they live, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. Different comments from people depending on where they live and also depending, of course, on political factions. There are a lot of conservatives, actually, who want to identify Obama with Lincoln, not in the way that progressives might want to identify Obama
with Lincoln.
What, saying
he's a bumpkin and he doesn't know what he's doing?
Well,
and a dither, as they said about Lincoln in 1861?
People did, and I think it's fair to call Lincoln a ditherer in early 1861, actually. No, but people see Lincoln as the sort of embodiment of an oppressive, centralizing federal government. People even say, well, Lincoln imposed the first national income tax, and Lincoln was trying to sort of impose these unconstitutional national policies, and so they obviously draw certain parallels to Obama from that.
Well, the thing about Lincoln, again, I felt happily ignorant as I was reading your book. I didn't realize quite how close we came to an entirely other history, that a counterfactual history of America was very possible. If not for Lincoln, it seems like a deal might have been made and secession might not have happened, or secession might have happened peacefully.
Yeah, and I think one of the most significant things that Lincoln did was that he sort of maneuvered the South into firing the first shot in a very conscious way, in a way that actually later generations of Southerners have pointed to as this sort of moment of Lincoln's villainy in starting the war. But he knew that the war was going to start one way or another, and he wanted to make sure that it came in the form of this, well, Pearl Harbor-esque attack against the North. And I really think that the greatest blunder of the South in the entire Civil War was attacking Fort Sumter.
And I was amazed to learn, I knew of P.T. Barnum's entertainment complex in Lower Manhattan that had plays and shows and all kinds of things all the time. But as the Fort Sumter crisis was becoming more of a crisis, as these Union soldiers were besieged there, he put on a play about it in real time with actors playing these real officers.
And it was very surreal. You know, here's this little two-acre island in the middle of Charleston Harbor with a few dozen guys there, these Union soldiers and officers who had been previously completely obscure. And they're basically, they're not doing anything but sit there.
And being hungry.
And being hungry
and
being cold and sort of chopping up their furniture to burn for firewood. And yet, somehow, in the process of this, they're becoming national celebrities and national heroes. And they're getting, you know, these letters from women asking for locks of their hair. You can go to the Library of Congress and find these letters that are pouring in from all over the country, asking for photographs, asking for autographs. And there was a sort of a possibility for national celebrity that came out of the war, too, that was unlike any previous American experience.
The historian Adam Goodhart is my guest today. Like P.T. Barnum's actors playing the part of Civil War soldiers in 1861, there are still men and women dressing up for make-believe battle today. I'm talking, of course, about Civil War reenactors.
Today I'm the federal commander of the siege of Bridgeport.
Serious reenactors spend hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars every year to relive the battles. And they'll tell you that if you just give it one weekend, put aside the errands and the smartphone and the TiVo, you'll get hooked too. Last week at the Siege of Bridgeport in Alabama, reenactors weren't just fighting each other. They had to contend with the weather as well.
No idea what we're doing.
They're going to do whatever I tell them to do. I am Michael Cheeks.
A little quicker, people.
I'm out of East Tennessee in the Knoxville area. I am commander of the 1st Tennessee Cavalry, United States Volunteers.
My name's Sarah Cheeks, and I'm his daughter. I'll be 21 in August.
She attended her first reenactment when she was
6 weeks old.
About 6 weeks old. And she has been coming to reenactments ever since. You know, for some reason, it's a lot easier to get a female that can ride a horse than it is a male. So I don't see them as females. I see them as cavalry troopers. And they can set a horse and fire a gun. They're my kind of people. My daughter, she's been raised on horses all her life and can probably outride any man here.
I mean, there's not much more to it. If I'm on the back of a horse and a gun, I'm happy.
Why not just put on a big old hoop skirt and a pretty dress?
Have you seen the weather? Have you seen the weather? Do you know how hard those are to clean? Not worth it.
Most of the people, you know, I had ancestors fought on both sides of the war. I had a great-grandfather, a great-great-grandfather, and a great-great-uncle that fought up in Indiana. I had a great-great-grandfather that fought in Kentucky. And they all fought in the same battles. So I could have had one ancestor kill the other two.
It's not big boys playing with big toys. It's a case of getting in touch with your own family and your own heritage.
For some of us, it's just the pleasure of being with other people. For some of us, it's shooting guns, playing with horses. Some of us, it's honoring family members that died in the war.
I'm Missy Baldwin, and I'm from Mineral Bluff, Georgia. My husband is with the 28th Georgia Company. I am wife of a soldier, but when I'm here, my daughter and I, we just kind of portray life back then. I think it was simpler. I think it's probably similar. I mean, things like the Civil War, they start because people feel threatened in their freedoms, and when people think so differently, to make them come together and get a compromise of some sort going, it's a hard thing to do. So in that light, we're probably a lot alike. We're fortunate enough not to actually be in war amongst ourselves yet, but hopefully we won't go there.
We've got a slideshow with lots of images from the Bridgeport reenactment at studio360.org. Gigi Duban produced our story. Coming up, we return to where the war began.
Some would rather leave that wound closed. Those who don't want to hear the story, those who don't want to tell the story, are part of the problem, not part of the solution.
150 years after the shots at Fort Sumter, we ask, did the war ever really end? That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
We nail a sign up above the door. God bless our little Civil War. God bless.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. William Faulkner once famously said, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." And so today we are marking the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. My guest is the journalist and historian Adam Goodhart. His new book, 1861, explores the intense ambivalence, the internal war within those Americans who decided to fight their fellow countrymen. Goodhart wrote the book after discovering a trove of personal letters in an old plantation house attic on the eastern shore of Maryland.
Literally nobody had undone these little bundles of papers since they were wrapped up, in most cases, in the 19th century. So we're in this sort of King Tut's tomb of American history. And one of the bundles of paper that we found was all wrapped up tightly, tied with silk ribbon, and on the outside was the date 1861. And inside, there were letters from a U.S. Army officer stationed out in Indian Territory, way far away from where the quote-unquote action was happening when the Civil War began. And he was from Maryland. He was from this plantation. He was writing to his family back home. And he was trying to figure out, what am I going to do at this moment in history? Do I stay with the Army? Do I stay with the Stars and Stripes that I've been loyal to since I was a teenage cadet at West Point? Or as a person from a slave-owning family, from a slave-holding state, am I loyal to the South? Do I become a founding father of this new nation? And so that moment, that discovery, just brought home to me how the Civil War was not just a conflict between people, but within people.
Yeah. And by the way, not only did you have this improbable, implausible eureka moment, but this colonel had been a classmate of Robert E. Lee's as a
teenager.
At West Point.
Yeah, he was a classmate of Robert E. Lee's. He was a friend of Jefferson Davis. In fact, when the Civil War breaks out, one of his sons is at West Point learning to become a U.S. Army officer. The other one is living with Jefferson Davis and his family while he attends medical school. And so the one son goes off and fights for the Union. The other one goes off and fights for the Confederacy. And like many American families, this is literally a house divided.
In Charleston, where these soldiers had been the soldiers of America until a few months earlier,
yes,
now they're suddenly they were transformed into enemies. We sent a reporter, producer down to Charleston to take a look and talk to people to find out that to them it's a very living wound in some ways. Let's listen to that piece.
As a child, we would go to Fort Sumter. My father, we always had a boat and would go out there to see it.
That's Joseph Riley. He was born in Charleston.
And you get up on the fort. It's like an eagle's nest almost, because it's elevated and you're in the middle of this gorgeous harbor. You can see the ocean. You can see a Fort Johnson from which the first shot was fired, or look over and see the beautiful city of Charleston, the skyline of steeples.
I met Joseph Riley at his office in City Hall. Riley is the mayor, a job he's had for 35 years. And like many here, he has ancestors who fought for the Confederacy.
You know, one thing about the Civil War and the South is that Southerners have an experience that the rest of America didn't have, and that is they lost a war. We're in a city where you can touch buildings that were scarred by the war. In fact, the building that we're in, City Hall, which was built in 1801, when we restored the building several years ago, we saw where a cannonball had come right through the building.
I know it's painful for some. You know, some would rather leave that wound closed. But I don't think that way.
That's Joe McGill. He's a program officer for the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
I think that those who don't want to hear the story, those who don't want to tell the story, are part of the problem, not part of the solution.
McGill helped to preserve Morris Island, where an African-American Union regiment tried to capture Fort Wagner. But he feels like the subject of slavery is still too painful for some. He started what he calls the Slave Dwelling Project, where he travels to old slave cabins and spends the night there, like the one at Middleton Place Plantation, just north of Charleston. I make my way through the impressive landscape gardens and past a pile of rubble that once was the main house. Union soldiers sacked and burned it during the war. Beyond the stables, in the middle of a swept dirt yard, is Eliza's place, a wood frame house in the style of a two-family slave cabin. It has a broad porch along the front with two doors, each opening onto a two-room dwelling. And the rooms are tiny. You'd be hard-pressed to fit more than a queen-size bed in one. This is where Joe McGill recently built a fire, cooked a meal, unfurled his sleeping bag, and settled into sleep.
I don't have dreams. I don't remember having dreams while I've been in a cabin. But my thoughts are about those people who spent time in those places, the mothers who would give birth to children, and their children could be taken from them at any given time with no recourse. You think about these things. But there were previous days where I've had fellow Civil War reenactors with me. And when that's the case, you know, we can engage in those conversations about slavery, conversations that are not very common and comfortable in a more public setting.
How you doing?
Jeanette Lee doesn't need restored slave dwellings to help her confront the past. She grew up across the street from it.
When I'm sitting here at nighttime, you know, and sewing, I be thinking about my mama. I think about my great-grandmother who worked on Boone Hall Plantation as a cook for over 55 years. My mother really was born and raised on Boone Hall, right across the street. And sometimes, you know, when you go over and look at the cabin and stuff, you wonder how they survived. But they did. They did. Make it better for us.
Jeanette worked for many years at a bank here in Charleston. Since retiring, she's devoted herself to perfecting a craft she learned as a child, making intricate sweetgrass baskets.
When our people came over as enslaved Africans, they brought their knowledge with them, and walking through, they see material familiar to them that's, you know, from Africa. Then they start making the baskets. This is bulrush. This is the palmator.
It's a craft passed down through her family over generations.
You just put your hole and then push it through with the palmator. Mama showed me how to do certain things because I would make the bottoms for her. And we would sit out on the porch, and I said, Mama, slow down. She said, oh, no, I can't slow down. She said, you go ahead and do what you got to do, and then I'll come back and I'll help you. But she sewed rings around me because she was very fast at it, and I was sort of slow. I'm still sort of slow at it, but I get to where I want to go.
My name's Randy Burbage. And we're heading for the Fort Lamar Heritage Preserve, where the Battle of Secessionville took place.
For most of us, the Civil War happened a long time ago, but not for Randy. For him, the history of the war is alive in the details. He knows where the bodies fell.
We're on Folly Road now, and we'll take a left in a few minutes and head up into a neighborhood. The fort is right there in the middle of a neighborhood.
And why is this area significant to you?
It was one of the bigger battles in South Carolina, and it was early in the war, in the summer of 1862. And my great-great-grandmother's younger brother was here, and he was killed during the battle. So this, at the time, this was all cotton fields here that the troops had to march through. And they attacked this fort at 4 o'clock in the morning, so it was still dark.
Burbage is the president of the Confederate Heritage Trust, which preserves battlefields and other artifacts of the Confederacy. The organization recently drew fire for co-sponsoring a secession gala in Charleston. It was widely perceived as a celebration of a government founded on slavery.
So we're going to get out and walk on the fort over here now. This was a pretty tragic battle. 200 Confederates were casualties here that night. 50 of them died.
620,000 dead is too many people to get your mind around. 50 people is like, imagine everyone in your office, dead, or all the families on your cul-de-sac.
See, this mound here is all part of the fort. We've left the brush there so kids don't ride bicycles on them. Julia Schuler, my grandmother's little brother, was right along in here. This is where Company I, Lieutenant Humbert's company was. And I'm pretty sure that he was probably killed by men from the 8th Michigan who actually breached the fort right here and were firing at the cannon crews. He was on 8-inch Columbiad working in he right in here. There were about 600 Union casualties that night, and it was a pretty gruesome sight the next morning when the sun came up.
Randy reenacts the Battle of Secessionville every year. Joe McGill, who's trying to preserve slave dwellings, also takes part in reenactments. He portrays a black soldier from the famous 54th Massachusetts Regiment. It's about history, but it's also about pride.
You know, it's good to see a little kid, as I explained to them, you know, dressed in a Civil War uniform, in some cases smelling a campfire smoke, that there were blacks that served as soldiers, as Union soldiers in the Civil War. It gives us something to talk about.
Mayor Joseph Riley promises that the commemoration of the start of this bloody war is going to be a solemn, not celebratory one, like the 100th anniversary back in 1961. But not everybody wants to drag around the weight of history. Jeanette Lee, the basket maker, she doesn't care if it's the 100th anniversary or the 150th or the 200th.
And some people make all the hoot and holler about the Civil War. I'm not getting involved in it. And those who want to do it, they got to tell me why, you know, it's so important to dig that up. You know, let bygone be bygone. Let sleeping dog lie. That's the way I feel about it. We were enslaved. It wasn't a good thing. We are here now. So let's go on.
For Studio 360, I'm Carrie Hillman.
You can see some pictures of our visit to Charleston at studio360.org.
Oh, my sweet Carolina. What compels me to go? Oh, my sweet disposition. May you one day carry me home.
I'm here with Adam Goodhart, the author of 1861. After the first artillery shells hit Charleston's Fort Sumter on the night of April 12th, the news reached New York in a matter of hours. One New Yorker shocked by this sudden turn of events was a poet named Walt Whitman.
Whitman was here in New York. He was attending an opera performance on 14th Street. He left just before midnight. He's walking through the streets, and he hears this sort of clatter of racing feet, and it's these newsboys racing along with extra editions of the newspapers yelling, "Extra, extra, Fort Sumter attacked!" And he sees underneath all the street lamps in Lower Manhattan, there are little groups of men standing huddled over these papers and talking about it. And that was a moment that changed Whitman's life, just as it changed America.
And you write of him having a kind of singular relationship with Abraham Lincoln, really.
Yeah, and it was a relationship that actually began long before Lincoln was even president, in a way. There's an essay that Whitman wrote in the 1850s before he'd ever heard of Abraham Lincoln, where he's talking about this sort of race of timid politicians who had come to rule America at that point. And he said, "What we need is some strong, lanky, bearded, tanned flatboatman to come from out of the West, from out of Indiana or Illinois, and step into Washington and bring something wholly new." And he'd never heard of Lincoln. It's
he
incredible.
Conjured him. Yeah.
Well, you know, the great poets and great novelists are prophetic that way, aren't they?
Another great novelist, Mark Twain, who was a Confederate.
A very reluctant Confederate.
Officer, but reluctant, exactly, as you describe. I mean, and he saved the Stars and Stripes at one point.
Yeah, Mark Twain actually, he was very ambivalent. He was, of course, a Missourian. He was a steamboat pilot on the Mississippi. When the war began, he joined this little local Missouri militia regiment that was going off to fight the Yankees. And he actually wrote a story about this, this sort of comic short story, the history.
Afterward.
That's right, afterward.
Long afterward.
Yeah. And it's a really interesting, I mean, like a lot of Twain's works, this very minor work has sort of comedy that suddenly turns into black tragedy at the end. He's talking about these local boys going off and fighting sort of non-existent Yankees, running around the woods, getting chased by farmers' dogs and things like that. And then finally at the end of the story, there's an alarm that a Yankee horseman is galloping up the road towards them, a squadron of Yankee cavalry, and they all pull out their guns and they shoot, and this Yankee topples to the ground and they run up to him, turn him over, and he's just some civilian man, some guy that they've just killed. And they're all just immediately sickened by this. And that's the end of Twain's story. And we don't know whether that event literally happened to him. But in fact, after just a few weeks of this sort of toy soldiering, Mark Twain did exactly what Huck Finn did at the end of Huck Finn. He lit out for the territories. He headed out with his brother to Nevada and sort of remade himself from a Southerner into a Westerner as a way of escaping.
One of the reasons I think, in addition to the enormity of the issues and the death and everything else that the Civil War entailed, one of the reasons we feel closer to it than certainly the Revolutionary War, I think, is because it was photographed, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah, it was photographed, and also the writing that comes out of the Civil War is just amazing. And it's not just works by Walt Whitman and others that are sort of part of the national canon, but also just the letters that have come down through families. A couple of years ago, we read this letter, and after class, one of my students hung around, and he's actually a Marine who had come back not too long before from fighting in Iraq. And he said, you know, this guy writing from Gettysburg, he got it right. That's what combat is like. That's what it feels like to have things being fired at you and knowing that your life could end at any moment. And it's something that I think actually in this age of military censorship, in this age of ephemeral emails and text messages and Skype calls, we're not going to have about contemporary history necessarily.
So we've seen our understanding, the popular conception of the American Civil War change again and again and again. 50 years from now, when you're an old man sitting by your holographic fire, what will the understanding be then, do you think?
You know, it's really very hard for us to say now. I think just a few years ago, let alone a few decades ago, it would have been almost impossible for Americans to imagine that at the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, we would have a black man in the White House, which, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that I found that also blew my mind in doing my research is that the issue of a black president was debated in 1860. People were literally talking about that possibility and saying, well,
If
we start down this slippery slope of admitting that black people have any rights whatsoever, it's going to end up with a black guy in the White House. And in fact, there was a parade right here in New York where the Democrats who were opposing Lincoln in the 1860 election marched holding a huge banner, and on it was a sort of a racist caricature of a black man. And it said underneath, the Republican candidate for president in 1864. So that what they were saying was, in 4 years' time, these Republicans are going to be giving us a black man in the White House. Well, it took a little longer than that, but I'm glad we got there.
Adam Goodhart, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Adam Goodhart is the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. You can also read his work at the New York Times Disunion blog. And if you want to know how beards, yes, beards, played a role in the war, according to Adam Goodhart, go to our website, studio360.org. Coming up, a contemporary artist tries to go beyond South and North and red states and blue states with a whole new way of mapping Americans.
What if we could gerrymander our congressional districts, not by who's conservative and who's liberal or whatever, but by, you know, who wants to go out on a Friday night and who wants to stay home and watch a movie?
You're listening to Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
I am following the river down the highway through the cradle of the Civil War. I'm going to Graceland, Memphis, Tennessee.
We're remembering today the beginning of the Civil War, 150 years ago on April 12th, and the long shadow that it still casts over American life. When you think of the Civil War, there's a good chance the images in your mind come from the photos of Matthew Brady and his cameramen, generals and soldiers posing next to tents or battlefields scattered with dead bodies. Photography had just been invented 20, 25 years before, but quick mass reproduction of photographs wasn't really possible. Very few people back then actually saw Brady's pictures. So when civilians had depictions of battles taking place, they were mostly engraved drawings from the weekly magazines.
The illustrated weekly had emerged in the 1850s as a new medium full of print and illustration.
That's Peter Wood, an emeritus professor at Duke University.
And these came out on a fairly regular basis. It was as interesting to people then as war as a news and an entertainment and information subject is to us today.
Mary Panzer is an historian specializing in photography.
The photographing of events was so cumbersome. You needed other people to interpret.
And so as the war began, illustrators went to the front as well.
Illustrators like Winslow Homer. He was a successful young freelancer for magazines like Harper's Weekly, doing street scenes, couples skating on ponds, that sort of thing. When the war broke out, he went to the front, embedded with the Army of the Potomac.
Photographers on the battlefield can only deal with things that are standing still. Homer can capture action.
Homer makes a picture of a cavalry charge.
It's like he makes snapshots before you could make snapshots.
Hand-to-hand combat, surgeons operating.
I mean, the picture of his that's probably most familiar is the sharpshooter in the tree. It's a young, anonymous man watching out and prepared with a weapon and ready.
And he uses the advantage that an illustrator has over a photographer. He takes his point of view right up in the tree with the sharpshooter. So you're perched up in the tree watching this sniper take aim. The artist could imagine himself high up in the air or even, in Homer's case, behind enemy lines. An image called A Shell in Rebel Trenches was published in Harper's in January of 1863. And it shows Union cannons in the distance across the river bombarding a Confederate fortification. And in the foreground, you see a Confederate officer with his sword drawn, forcing black slaves to reinforce the battlements just as a shell is exploding. And what's striking is not only does he put northern viewers behind enemy lines, but he also makes a black figure the center of the image so that you see the shocked face of a black worker who is realizing that the Army of the Potomac that is trying to liberate him may also be the cause of his death.
Homer was out on the battlefield, but he was also making sketches of everyday life, giving it a kind of dignity and interest and lyricism that was new.
He does an amazing picture at the end of the war called The Empty Sleeve, and it shows a veteran still wearing his Union cap, but his left arm has been shot off in the war. His empty sleeve is pinned across his heart, and he's sitting in a carriage beside the woman who must be his wife or his girlfriend. And both of them have troubling stares on their faces as they look ahead into the future. I think Homer couldn't have drawn such a powerful picture and captured that sense so well if he hadn't experienced some of that himself. the more I've studied Homer, the more I get a sense that he was deeply affected by it, more than we have understood.
Now, Winslow Homer is remembered for his work in the decades after the war as one of our great painters of land and seascapes. And the images we remember of the Civil War come not from illustrators, but from photography. Matthew Brady was the go-go visionary who saw the potential of photos as historical chronicle, and also the most successful portrait photographer of his time. It was as if Richard Avedon had gone to cover Vietnam.
In Brady's case, he's making portraits of the rich and famous.
Brady was really in the business of manufacturing fame. He liked the celebrity of politics. He liked the celebrity of generals. And when the celebrities and the headline makers were now on the battlefields of the Civil War, he went out to find them and to photograph them.
The equipment was bulky. Lighting issues were complex.
You essentially had to take an entire darkroom with you. And Brady made up big wagons.
Wagons in which they could develop their pictures.
And eventually had several teams of photographers all around the country making these pictures and sending them back. No one had ever been on a battlefield. They thought war looked like Napoleon on a horse. That's what they thought. Or Washington crossing the Delaware. Then you get out to the battlefield and it's chaos and it's fast, cannons and horses, noisy and it's confusing. They didn't find General McClellan all ready to pose next to a stump. There were bodies everywhere. And Brady's team of photographers included Alexander Gardner. They went out and brought back pictures of these bodies in battlefield. And they also brought back images that could be turned into stereo views. So not only could you see bodies, but you could see them in three dimensions. It was really horrific.
So, for instance, in July of 1863, the same month as Gettysburg, Brady has a big exhibit in his Washington studio of photographs from the front. One of the reviewers in the Atlantic Monthly writes about how horrendous this is to see these large and very visceral images of war. People were revolted and turned away and could scarcely bear to see what war was creating.
Brady himself must have been unhappy with what happened. Certainly he got a lot of attention, but he didn't make a lot of sales. And never again for the rest of the war, until very, very late, did you see any dead bodies in Brady's pictures. They were all heroic soldiers. They were very patriotic pictures, and I think Brady himself was a great patriot and wanted to promote the idea of a war that was worth fighting. His employee, Alexander Gardner, went off on his own after that. Gardner's pictures are the ones that have the bodies laid out on the battlefield. Those are the ones we sort of remember, and those are the ones you think of as the beginnings of photojournalism. But in fact, they're faked. We know now that Gardner got there on the field of Gettysburg, found himself a couple bodies, especially one, that he dragged around and he set up in different places. And he added props. He added a gun. Any Civil War history buff would know that there would be no gun left after a battle. Those guns were too valuable. The shoes were too valuable. So a lot of what we remember about the Civil War are constructions. They're no more realistic than a movie. Brady, part of the reason why he was investing in all of these pictures was because he figured he was going to amass the largest archive devoted to the Civil War, and that it would be immensely valuable to have such a thing. What he discovered was that no one was interested. In 1867, he tried to sell his entire collection to the New York Historical Society, and nobody wanted to buy it. No one wanted to see this stuff. It took him another generation until the 1890s when people began to come back to him. And in that, he was like a talking history an encyclopedia. And it was only then that the photographs of the Civil War found an audience, really and truly.
Mary Panzer is the author of many books on photography. Historian Peter Wood is an emeritus professor at Duke University. You can see images of Matthew Brady's and Winslow Homer's war pictures at studio360.org. That piece was produced by Studio 360's Jonathan Mitchell. Next week, our look at the Civil War's continuing impact takes on one of America's most iconic and controversial songs, Dixie.
People now are denied the use of the song because the politically correct say that it's offensive.
It was only during the 2000 presidential election that the red state, blue state divide became the way we talk about American politics. But it is way too reductive and binary. In presidential votes, New York City may be very blue, and my home state of Nebraska is extremely red. But take a look at the real electoral map, precinct by precinct, and we're mostly just various shades of purple. I'm kind of a geek about this stuff, statistics and maps and what they tell us about ourselves. So I was intrigued when I heard about a project by an artist and computer programmer named Luc Dubois. He's created a new set of U.S. maps that reclassify us. His data is not from the polls or the census. It's from dating websites. He calls the series A More Perfect Union, and you can see some of the maps we're talking about at studio360.org.
In 2008, I decided to try my hand at doing online dating. I found it incredibly stressful, actually. I found it incredibly anxiety-ridden and stressful, that whole experience. You know, you do the usual stuff where you fill out all the little boxes, but then you have to write kind of two paragraphs of prose. You have to write a paragraph about, you know, who you are, and then you have to write a paragraph about who you want to be with. And so it's funny because in the first one, you kind of lie.
Ripped.
You know, because you have to put your best foot forward. So you kind of fudge stuff.
Boyish.
You kind of, you know, try to make yourself sound good.
Playful.
But then in the one about the person you want to meet, you're actually really, really honest because you have to be, right? It's in your interest to be.
Capable.
Noble.
Loyal.
It's a really interesting kind of duplicitous and really vulnerable act of self-identity. So I got it into my head. I would write some computer software to basically do word analytics on about 19 million singles profiles. I downloaded about 19 million of them from 21 different services. And then I had my computer stick in words replacing the names of all the cities and towns. And the word that gets stuck in there is the word that people in online dating services, single people, use in that town more than anywhere else in the country.
Washington, D.C. Interesting.
Worcester, Massachusetts. Obnoxious.
The number one word for New York City is now, right? Because in New York City, we want things now.
Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Curvy.
Boise, Idaho. Moxie.
Madison, Wisconsin is pierced.
Columbia, South Carolina, dependable.
Montgomery, Alabama, devotion.
Fort Worth, Texas, loving.
You know, if you're like a blue state guy, you sort of think, well, those are going to be my words. Those are going to show up in New York City, but they don't. You know, it's like New York City, you get editor and you get, you know, choreographer. You get a lot of professions.
Brooklyn.
Psychiatrist.
Perverted.
Freelance.
Punishment.
Schmuck.
Just the mere presence of the word is interesting.
Hot Springs, North Carolina. Redneck.
I don't think people use redneck, you know, sort of adopting the slur. One other interesting thing I found out was that, you know, Los Angeles, that's the one place where people talk a lot about, you know, their physical attributes.
Endowed.
Augmentation.
Flawless.
And how they like to have sex.
Booty.
Kissing.
Touching.
You know, you get lingerie.
Spanking.
Spanking's number one in Los Angeles. It's good stuff. 2010 was a census year, and so what I wanted to be able to do was basically collect my data the same summer they were taking the real census, summer of 2010, and present my findings just like the government does in the first quarter of 2011. So what I'll do is I'll look for a word like shy, and then I'll make a colored map of the country based on where all the shy people are. And it looks kind of like a red state, blue state thing. But instead of that meaning Republicans and Democrats, it means girls and boys. You can see that, you know, there's lots of shy people in the upper Midwest. People don't use that terminology as much on the coasts.
Shy.
Minnesota.
South Dakota.
Michigan.
Kinky.
Alaska.
New Mexico.
West Virginia.
I think if we as Americans looked a little bit closer at our country as a whole and had a lot more empathy for people's desires in different parts of the country, I think we'd feel a lot more connected to one another. I think we'd feel a lot less divisive.
Lonely.
Texas.
Illinois.
Indiana.
Kentucky.
Ohio.
Ohio.
What if we could gerrymander our congressional districts not by who's Republican and who's Democrat or who's conservative and who's liberal or whatever, but by, you know, who wants to go out on a Friday night and who wants to stay home and watch a movie?
Check out your hometown. How do your pining singles describe themselves? You can see Luc Dubois' More Perfect Union at studio360.org. Studio 360's Eric Malinsky produced our story. And that does it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Eric Malinsky,
John Delore,
Michael Guerriero,
Sarah D'Elia,
Katie Palmer,
Mary Du.
Special thanks this week to John Rudolph for his assistance in our Charleston story. And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, is it time to reinvent the board game Monopoly?
The game is literally just about waiting for people to run out of money and perish.
We found a game designer who has had it with Rich Uncle Pennybag.
And the only person who's having any fun is the one person who's causing this destruction.
We're giving Monopoly a makeover next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.